Let me just practice in there, see how it's coming. We're at for Mr. Joe McCarthy's home in Tonawanda, New York, on Tuesday, April 15, 1975. Let's see. Right now, right where we are. Pick up okay.
Well, this is all right, Mr. Murdoch. I'm very happy to be here with you, and I hope I give you some answers that you're looking for.
Well, I'm sure you will. It's a real thrill for me to be here. Remember that picture there?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. That was with the Cubs. That was taken out in Catalina Island.
You know where I got that from?
No, I couldn't tell you.
Fred
where.
Blake.
Where?
Fred Blake.
Fred Blake.
Sheriff Blake.
Sheriff Blake.
Yeah, down in Virginia.
Bluefield. Virginia.
Yeah.
Or West Virginia.
Yeah, Bluefield, West Virginia.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, he was a great pitcher
and
a great friend of mine.
Yeah.
We call him Sheriff.
Yeah, Sheriff. We had a real good interview with him.
Did you really?
Yeah, he's real nice. And
he is a very nice fellow.
And, you got a good story to tell? Got some stories to tell about him? Or?
Well, no, they're all good. And I remember when I left Chicago, he came up to the hotel the night I was leaving and told me he was very sorry. He was one of the few players that did that, and he's very sorry to see me go.
Yeah.
And I surely appreciated it.
Uh-huh.
Well, can you come back with it?
Okay.
I'm watching a pheasant out there.
Oh, I watched the baseball
last
night.
Oh, back in the cottage. Huh?
I'm thinking you folks will have to get out of here. I'm making the record.
Look who in here.
Oh, it's coming through real fine.
Did you see that cottage?
Oh, it's a little dollhouse. I just love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's adorable.
Okay, now let's. You were born in Philadelphia in 1887. Okay,
that's right.
What did your father do?
Is this on now?
Yep.
Well, my father was a contractor, and my father was killed. He had the job doing the work on the Mannheim Cricket Grounds. That was a great place where they played cricket years ago. He was killed there. Of course, I was only 3 months old at the time, and my mother had to just take charge and raise me the best she could.
Were there other children in the family?
Well, there was a few, yes.
Uh-huh. How did
I'm going to that.
Uh-huh.
Not too many children.
Uh-huh. Did she? That was quite a feat for her to raise.
Well,
how'd she do it?
Well, she, a lot of things were done years ago that you probably wouldn't want to do today, and they wouldn't have to do today.
Yeah.
You go out and work, that's the only thing, and I guess that's the answer to everything that what made our country and everything is real hard work.
Yeah. Did you live in the city?
No, we lived out in Germantown.
Oh.
That was the 22nd Ward. It was a separate little village years ago. Then it was taken in by the city.
Had your parents lived in this country very long, or did they come over?
Well, my mother was born in Ireland. My father was born in Ireland.
Were they married in Ireland or over?
No, they were married over here.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Very interesting. When did they come over from Ireland?
Well, I couldn't tell you, just give you the date. I know my mother came from the Ulster province in Ireland, and my father was from down in the lower part of Ireland.
But was your mother Catholic?
Yes, my mother
but
was Catholic.
She came
Catholic.
From Ulster.
Yeah. She come from Strabane. That was the County Mayo in the town of in the Ulster province. That's the flax country.
Uh-huh.
Now, I couldn't tell you. I know my father, I think, came from Cork.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. Did was your father any kind of an athlete, do you know?
No, I couldn't tell you that. I don't think there was much athletic work going on at the time. You didn't have many baseball clubs in those days, and you didn't have any other athletic sports, I guess.
Was Germantown a kind of Irish settlement?
No, it was founded by a German by the name of Francis Daniel Pastorius.
Uh-huh.
And they were unveiling a big monument in Vernon Park in Germantown for him when the first war broke out. And on account of him being a German, they had to board it up until the war was over.
Is that right? Yeah, I didn't like Germans then.
Yes. But that's a big ward in the city of Philadelphia, yeah. Germantown, 22nd Ward.
Mm-hmm. When did you first play ball, and where?
Well, I played amateur round, and then our club in Germantown was called the QAA, and that was named after the great Chu family. And Washington made his headquarters in the Chu Mansion during the Revolutionary War in Germantown. They had a Battle of Germantown. Uh-huh. And so we named our ball club after the Chu family. It was called the Chu AA, and that was really my first start in baseball.
Did you go to school in Germantown?
Yes, I went to school in Germantown.
Finish up high school there?
No, I didn't. I didn't get into high school. Uh-huh. But I did go up to Niagara University. I was up there in 1905 and 6. Mm-hmm. Then I started playing professional baseball.
How did you get over to Niagara from Philadelphia? Did your family move?
I was a pretty fair ball player at the time, and Niagara was looking for good ball players. I guess that's the only reason.
They recruited you?
Huh?
They recruited you then?
I don't know what you said.
Recruited?
No, it was through some friends of mine, and of course the big college was in Germantown. It was Niagara University.
Oh, Niagara was in Germantown.
Huh?
I was
Niagara University up at Niagara Falls.
Uh-huh.
But I'm saying that the mother house was the St. John's in Brooklyn.
I see, yeah.
But then we had another St. Vincent de Paul parish in Germantown. See, and through the knowing a lot of people and the connection, that's how I got to Niagara University.
Did you have any trouble getting in, not having finished high school?
No, I didn't.
Did you like it at Niagara?
Well, I liked it very much.
You played wonderful. Ball there?
Yes, I played ball there. I only played the one season at the end of 19... In fact, I was only there about one season. At the end of 1906, then I went out and started to play professional baseball.
When you were you working in Germantown during those years that you?
Well, when I was a kid, I worked. I worked in mills and I'd done all kinds of work naturally.
Uh-huh. Helped out the family finances that way.
The best I could, yeah.
Okay, now, did some professional scouts see you play at Niagara? Is that how you got your first contract?
No, they didn't have too many scouts around in those days.
Uh-huh.
And I came home, and then I went down and finished the season, and I went to...
It says Wilmington here is your first team. Wilmington?
No, well, that was in... Wilmington was my first job in 1907.
Uh-huh.
But this was in 6. I went down and I was in they called it the Peach League. It was down in Delaware, Dover, Delaware. And then I went up from there up to Catasauqua in the Lehigh Valley League. Those leagues, they were good little leagues. It was good semi-pro ball,
uh-huh.
But it wasn't under protection. See, then 1907, I went with the Wilmington Club in the Tri-State League.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't good enough.
How did you get on that team?
They give me my release. I wasn't good enough for the Wilmington Club, so I went out to Franklin, Pennsylvania, in the Interstate League.
Mm-hmm. Had a good year there.
Yes, I'd done pretty well in Franklin.
What'd your mother think of your playing ball?
Well, she liked it all right, but. She said she had seen it in Ireland before, but I don't think she did. It was called Rounders years ago.
Probably. Did she come to see you play much?
No.
Okay, well, you
moved... She was too busy working.
See, you had a pretty good year at Franklin, and did Toledo buy you?
Or? Yes, Toledo bought me from Franklin.
Uh-huh.
But that league broke up that winter.
The Interstate League.
The Interstate League disbanded, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was it pretty tough competition there, or Interstate League, or pretty good? What classification would it have been, probably?
Well, Toledo was in the American Association.
Yeah, Toledo was.
Of course, those leagues were Class A in those days. And then as the population grew, they raised them to Double A. And then they got from Double A, now they're Triple A.
Yeah, they don't have anything below it, practically.
No.
Was Toledo independently owned then?
No, Toledo was owned by
the Giants?
Charlie Summers, who owned the Cleveland Club at the time.
Did you ever meet Summers?
Yes, I met him once.
Is that right?
A very fine man. He was a big coal operator, I think. Yes.
He helped.
But he built the ballpark in Toledo called Swain Field.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was the finest minor league park built in the country in those days.
How many would it seat?
Well, it would seat about, including the beaches, about 18,000-20,000.
Right, huh? Yes. Great. Did you get pretty big crowds sometimes there?
Yes, it's very, very well, as long as you won.
Who was the manager?
Well, Bill Armour, he was one of the great managers. He's a fellow brought up Tite Cobb.
Yeah.
Well, he was president and manager of the Toledo Club.
He managed Cleveland for a while, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he managed Detroit for a while.
Uh-huh. Did Bresnahan run the...
Well, Bresnahan lived there, but he... Bresnahan bought the club in later years. Mm-hmm. See, the Giants owned the club. Mm-hmm. And Bresnahan, whether he bought it from the Giants or not, I don't know. But he was in there as a manager and president. He owned the ball club.
Well, how'd you like it at Toledo?
Very good. Yes, I liked it. I was there for,
just 3 years here.
Yes.
1908, 1910, and part of 11.
Part of 11, yes.
And, did you play second base all these years?
No, I played any place.
Oh, yeah?
I was a utility man.
Uh-huh. I see, yeah. What position did you prefer?
Well, it didn't make much difference to me,
played,
I guess. Yes,
I
could play the infield or outfield. Not too good, but fair enough to hang around, and I guess that was all you cared to do in those days.
Now, you went from Toledo to Indianapolis. What was the situation there?
Well, it was the same thing in Indianapolis.
You were traded or sold?
No, I stayed in Indianapolis until...
It's about half a season, I guess.
Yes, and then I went to Wilkes-Barre. They sold me to Wilkes-Barre in the New York State League.
Uh-huh. Had a couple pretty fair years there. I noticed that you managed Wilkes-Barre for a
part. Yes, I managed Wilkes-Barre in 1913.
And you're only about 26 years old.
That's right.
How'd that happen?
Well, Bill Clymer was the owner and manager of Wilkes-Barre.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clymer and another man in Wilkes-Barre owned the ball club. A fellow named Adam Turks. He had a big delicatessen in a saloon there. And Clymer came to manage the Buffalo Club. Came here. So he made me manager of the Wilkes-Barre Club. So the Wilkes-Barre Club then was sold in the end of 13, and Clymer brought me here to Buffalo.
I see. He must have spotted your managerial abilities at that rather early age then, huh?
Well, I don't know.
Did you think of yourself as a potential manager in these early years?
Well, I went on and played after that.
Yeah, I know, but
before I managed again. I came here and was here 2 years with the Buffalo Club 2 years, and then I went to Louisville.
But very clearly you had managerial talent.
That was up to somebody else to...
You yourself didn't really think of yourself as a manager.
No, I didn't. I figured I was just a player.
How did the Wilkes-Barre players treat you as a manager that
year? Oh, all right, because I played second base and I was just as good as the rest of them.
You're one of the boys?
That's right. No, I kind of...
There's a little distance between you.
Well, there is a little difference when you're managing. Yeah. You can't chum around with the players too much.
Yeah. Did you have any problems with discipline that year with Wilkes-Barre that you recall? Or
no, I didn't have any trouble. No trouble at all. No. In fact, we lost the championship by, I don't know how, a game and a half or something like that.
Yeah. Have any real stars with you that year that made it big later?
No.
You can think of?
No, they were all good. Most of them were players that had been in the AA League and come down. There were no kids, very few kids in the New York State League. It was a very good league. Very few young fellas in it.
Okay, now, how did you feel about coming to Buffalo with Clymer? Did you like that?
All right. Very good. I liked it very much. I was here with him for 2 years.
But
I was only with him 1 year, and then he went to Toronto. And you see, the Buffalo Ball Club was sold. And Joe Lennon, who owned the Boston Club, he bought the Buffalo Club and sold the Providence Club to Detroit. And then he bought the Buffalo Club, and Pat Donovan came in to manage the Buffalo Club, and Clymer went to Toronto. So I stayed here with Donovan, and at the end of the year, I jumped to the Federal League.
Oh.
I went over with the Brooklyn Feds.
And then the league broke up.
Federal League peace was declared that winter.
I see. Who recruited you for the Brooklyn Feds?
Well, John Gansel was the manager of the Brooklyn Club. Uh-huh. And Gansel used to manage the Rochester Club.
Did you ever meet Robert Ward, the owner?
No, they were the...
He died just about that time.
Yes. Well, the Ward family owned the Brooklyn Club in the Federal League. They were the big bakery people in Brooklyn.
Did you get a... was the contract much better than what you were getting? That is your Brooklyn contract?
Oh, well, naturally, if I didn't, I wouldn't have jumped. I wouldn't have gone over, yes.
But they really...
The Federal League was paying more money than I could get in the big league.
Okay, when the war was over, what happened to that Brooklyn contract?
Well, the Brooklyn contract, I had an agreement with them, and I got what money that I had coming to me, and then I had a privilege of going into the American Association. I couldn't come back into the International League because they decided not to take any players back that jumped to the Federal League from the International League. So therefore, I went to Louisville Club. I made my own deal with the Louisville Club. Clymer then went to Louisville to manage the Louisville Club. So I made a deal with Clymer and went to Louisville.
There was a lot of trouble with the Buffalo International League franchise, wasn't there, with in settling the peace terms? I've forgotten now.
No, there was no trouble. Stein owned the ball club, and he was an attorney here, and he was a very fine man. But the attendance, we conflicted with the Federal League in Buffalo, and it was pretty tough to support two clubs. So, therefore, the Federal League didn't do well here, and neither did we, financially.
Yeah. I've interviewed a chap who played with the Buffalo Feds in 1915. He lives not far from us, Cy Marshall. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's an old Philly pitcher.
Oh, yeah.
He jumped in 1914.
Uh-huh.
Or, yeah, 1915 he jumped. And he pitched for the... He was injured, didn't pitch much that year. He didn't get back. I think he went back to the American Association. But it was tough getting back into the majors, those that had been in, and some of the others, too. I didn't realize International League players who had jumped, though, couldn't get back to International League.
Yeah. No, they weren't allowed to come back. They put a rule in.
Well, how are things in Louisville?
Well, very good.
And you became manager there in 1919. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Well, that came about, Pat Flaherty was the manager.
Clymer was no longer manager?
No, Clymer then went up to, he went out to California, I think, to manage Seattle. Pat Flaherty was, the Louisville Club changed hands. Mr. Nabelkamp bought the Louisville Club. He was a big distiller for the Watson Company. And he bought over the Louisville Club and brought Pat Flaherty in. And Pat was a great left-hand pitcher years ago. You probably read about him, Pat Flaherty, yeah. He was one of the first that made a trip over to Japan years and years ago. Well, they brought Pat Flaherty in to manage the club, and and whatever took place, I don't know, but Pat left the club and went to Chicago and scouted for the White Sox. He and Comiskey, Mr. Comiskey, were pretty good friends, and so the neighbor camp asked me if I'd handle the club for the rest of the year, and I told him I would. So when the year was out, well, he was satisfied with the way I handled it, so I continued on.
Were you pleased at this opportunity to manage Louisville?
I was playing manager in Louisville for well up until about 21.
Did you like the idea of managing again there?
Well, I liked it, yes.
You feel honored?
I wanted to learn, and I wanted to, baseball was my life. I had no other trade, so I...
Well, he must have spotted this ability in you also, you know, the managing.
Well,
you didn't seem to think much about it yourself, but other people did, huh?
Well, maybe, I hope you're right on that. I don't know.
Yeah, you, he asked you to run the club and kept you on there. Who were some of your players in those Louisville years?
Well, it's a little tough. I'd be here for a week going over all that.
Any two or three names stand out?
Well, I had Joe Guy, and he was a great...
Indian.
Yeah, Indian. He was on my club at Ben Tincup, another Indian.
Yeah, it's the Indians. Huh?
And he was a pitcher. Guyan was an outfielder. Uh-huh. They were good players, good ball players. And I had a real good ball club. And Jay Kirk, quite a first baseman.
Yeah.
And good hitter, Bruno Betzel. Yeah. Good ball club. Bill Myers, one of my catchers. Uh-huh. He later managed...
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, yes.
Lute Boone wasn't on that team, was
Who?
He? Lute Boone?
Oh, I had Earl Coombs. Earl Coombs.
Coombs.
We sold, got Earl Coombs. He was just a kid up in the bluegrass country, and he made good that year, and the second year we sold him to the Yankees.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then later on I caught up with him, and... He played for me in New York, too.
Yeah,
so he played for me in Louisville and also New York.
Yeah, uh-huh. Was there a Nick Cullop with Louisville?
Yes.
This was the other Nick, the pitcher.
Pitcher, yes.
Norman.
Yeah, he was a left-hand pitcher.
Yeah,
he was a good pitcher.
I've interviewed the other Nick Cullop. He's in Columbus, the hitter, the outfielder.
Yeah,
who also started pitching, I guess.
Did he?
Yeah, but he made an outfield. He could hit so well, they made an outfield out of him. Why did you not play anymore after 21?
Well, I felt that it was a little tough playing and managing, and I figured I was about washed up as a player, and as long as I had a contract, then I had a contract for 2 years after that, see, and just a manager's contract.
Did you get...
Mr. Nabelkamp done away with the player end of it.
Did you get more as a player-manager than just as a manager? Or?
Well, naturally, but after I won the championship in 21 and beat the Baltimore club in a Junior World Series...
Beat Baltimore.
I naturally, he figured that I was entitled to more money.
Yeah. That Baltimore was some team to beat, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was a good ball club.
Best... Probably minor league teams ever put together.
Yeah.
Okay, now, anything else stick out in your mind about your years at Louisville as manager?
No, it was very...
Did you win any more titles?
I was very happy down there. And
you got married when you were there, is that right?
Yes, I got married in 21 after we won the championship.
Where did you meet your wife?
Well, I've known my wife for a long time.
She from...
My wife's a Buffalo girl.
Uh-huh. You moved your residence to Buffalo when you came
right.
over with Clymer that year.
That's then. Right.
Did you live out here then? Or
no, I lived in the city of Buffalo.
Uh-huh. And how did you meet your wife? At a ball game? Or?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
Hell, I don't know whether I met her in the saloon or where I met her.
Now,
that's not necessary.
How about your being signed by the Cubs? How did that come about? Can you tell me how they got you to manage them in 26 or 25? Who called you or who contacted you there? The Chicago Cubs.
Have you got that on?
Yeah.
Did you ask the question?
How the Cubs got you?
Oh, well, when I went to Chicago, Jack Doyle, he was a scout for the Chicago Cubs, and I talked with him. I was in Columbus, Ohio, and he asked me if I was tied up in Louisville after the season was over, and I told him, no, my contract run out. And he said, have they got an option on your contract? I said, no. They did have an option on the last one I signed, but I said, the last one I, on the one before this one, but this last contract, I said, the option disappeared. So I said, when the season was over, I was free to go any place. And then I had a call from Bill Veeck, and I met Bill Veeck at French Lick Springs. And we talked over different things, and I talked over managing the Cubs, and he and I come to some agreement that I would manage the Cubs at the end of the season in Louisville. Well, we won the championship in Louisville and played Baltimore again, but Baltimore beat us that year, and that was in 25. So at the end of the year, I went to Chicago and signed a contract, and from then on managed the Cubs.
Was it a disappointment for you? It probably was, about not playing ball in the big leagues, or had you?
No, that didn't bother me. No, I wanted a livelihood out of baseball. And I had to get it out of baseball because I didn't have any other trade, and I didn't have a good enough education to demand something in the way of a teacher or anything. So
well, you made it big managing, certainly. So I talked to Woody English once over, he's in Newark, Ohio, and he says that you put together the Cubs team, which won the pennant, by picking out players you had seen in the association.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I did bring in Hack Wilson. Hack Wilson belonged to the Giants, and they forgot to recall him. And so the Cubs had finished last year, but I went in there, and I got Hack Wilson from the in the draft. Uh-huh. See, we drafted Hack Wilson. And
who was he with?
Well, he was with Toledo. Uh-huh. But he belonged to the Giants, and they forgot to recall him, and that put him in the draft.
But they were sorry.
So then I bought Rick Stevenson. He was from Indianapolis, and I got Woody English from Toledo and Freddie McGuire from Toledo. And I got Earl Webb from Louisville, an outfielder, and I got Petey Scott from Kansas City. So I had a pretty good idea of the ability of some of those fellas in the American Association.
Uh-huh.
Those are the ones I got.
You just bought them from there?
Yes, we bought them.
They didn't belong to any other major league clubs out on option or anything?
No, they belong to the clubs we bought them from.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, Toledo, I don't know who owned the Toledo club when I just forget now.
Maybe Bresnahan. Could it have been Bresnahan?
No, it wasn't Bresnahan because Stengel was the manager. Yeah. Casey Stengel was the manager at the time.
That was some team you put together. How did you do in your first year there, 26 or 27? How did those first couple years go at Chicago?
In Chicago?
Yeah.
Well, you can look up the record. We done pretty well, I guess.
27, was it? You had the pennant won, or you lost in the last couple games on an Eastern trip? Was that the story? Or you remember?
No.
I thought Woody English told me some story about having the...
Well, I'd have to go over that now.
You had a pretty real good year, and it almost had it won, and then something happened on an Eastern.
No, we had a five-game lead, but the five-game lead was over five other different ball clubs. Now, we had to keep on winning because one of those other five clubs were going to win. They had to win, see? So we lost a few games, and the first thing you know, they caught us. We didn't have a five-game lead over one club.
Uh-huh.
We went east one time, and we were in second place on the last Eastern trip, and we won 9 out of 14 and still finished second. But the Cardinals come along and beat the Phillies 5 straight over in Philadelphia, and they went ahead and they won it.
Well, 1929 was a great year.
Yes, we had a good year in 29. Yeah. Well, you can't, when you have a good year in baseball, you got to have at least two or three of your top men having good years too. Because a good year with one man won't win it for you. You got to have good years out of two or three of your good men, see. And if you do, then you're going to be tough to beat.
Who had their good years that year? I don't know.
Well, Wilson and Hornsby and Kyler, I had three men that had pretty good years, and Hartnett and Grimm, they all seemed to come together.
Yeah. How about your pitching that year?
The pitching was all right. The pitching was good enough. And Charlie Root and Blake and Joe Bush, Carlson. Yeah. I had quite a few good. Art Knepp was with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was Hornsby to manage as a player?
Oh, he was all right. I never had any trouble with him. I ain't going into detail. Don't go into detail. I don't want that. I can't talk about this fellow's dead. I can't talk about the dead.
Okay. How about Kyler was, you got him for Pittsburgh, right?
Yes. We traded Sparky Anderson. Sparky Adams.
Yeah.
Sparky Adams for Kyler.
That was a good deal, wasn't it? Kyler had a great year at Pittsburgh, but they didn't play him, I guess, in 27.
Yeah, well, Sparky was a good little second baseman, and Kyler was, he was a good outfielder and better hitter.
Who'd you have at second base, McGuire?
Freddie McGuire.
Uh-huh. And English at...
Not another boy by the name of Beck, Clyde Beck.
And the outfield was Wilson, Stevenson, and...
Kyler,
yeah. With Danny Taylor in that team?
Who?
Danny Taylor.
Well, he come up in 30.
I see.
Yeah. We got him from Memphis, I think, in 30.
Okay. And who is your backup catcher? Is that Jimmy Wilson?
I had Mike Gonzalez.
Taylor, I guess.
Yeah, and a boy by the name of Jack Sherry.
Now, 1930, Wilson had that great year. You know, all those home runs. And,
yeah.
That was a...
Listen, I can't go through with all this. It's getting me... It's too long.
I'm sorry.
Too long, yeah. To start with, you want me to go through the Yankees now after this?
Okay, you had real good luck at Chicago there, and then you went over to the Yankees, and you were out of baseball in 31, is that right?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, you
out
went
of
to the Yankees in 31.
Yeah, I went with the Yankees in 31.
And had 15 great years.
They were wonderful years, yeah.
How many pennants did you win over there? Did you keep track of all those?
No, I think it was, I don't know, it was about 7 or 8.
It
was very good. And of course, I worked for wonderful people, and Colonel Rupert and Mr. Barra, Ed Barra.
Yeah.
And I had two bosses. I had really one boss, Ed Barra. The Colonel didn't boss me much. And so I was very fortunate to work for such nice people.
Yeah. Did you ever get to meet the Colonel very often?
Oh, yes. Quite often.
Did he have you in the brewery there, huh?
Well, I lived at 86 in Madison, and he lived up on 5th Avenue right around the corner. So I used to see him quite often.
He never got over his German accent, did he?
Oh, yes. He didn't call many people by their first name, see, but that was all. He was a very fine man.
How do you address you? As
McCarty.
Wade Hoyt says how he always called him Hoyts.
Well.
Roots and Hoyts. So, he was quite an elegant dresser, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was probably a first nighter years ago when he was young. But he was single.
Uh-huh.
And,
That barrel. Was George Weiss around yet, or did that come a little later?
Well, George came into the picture a little later when the colonel bought the Newark and Kansas City franchise.
I see. Uh-huh.
See, then sent George Weiss in there to take care of the minor league clubs.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it was... How'd you like the Yankee Stadium? Is that a nice ballpark?
Oh, naturally. It was the best and the biggest. And, of course, when I look back now and I figure they're tearing it down, I can't figure why, but they have a reason, I guess.
They're building it so there are no columns in it at all, no posts.
Uh-huh.
You can see without having to sit behind a post. That's one thing they're doing, but... I don't know, they ripped off the roof. They're going to have just a little shallow roof now, which won't cover you very much in case it rains. I don't know. I thought it was a pretty nice ballpark.
It was. It was a great ballpark.
Yeah. So, you won four straight pennants there in the late 30s. Great team there with DiMaggio and... Gehrig and Lazzari, Joe Gore. You came up with so many good players. That Newark just kept feeding the Yankees, didn't they, with some fine young players?
Not necessarily.
Well, Gordon and Keller and Henrik.
Well, we bought Gordon from... Gordon was a triple-A ball player when we bought him. We bought him from the Coast League. And we just... he never played shortstop. We sent him into Newark for a year. But he had played triple-A league, so we... paid triple-A price for Gordon. And Johnny Murphy, we had him in St. Paul, and we sent him over to Newark. So they weren't really developed in Newark.
I see.
They had been great ball players when they come into Newark.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They didn't come up through some little minor league club into Newark. Rizzuto did.
Yeah.
Rizzuto and Pretty and Vera.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't there when Vera come in.
And Henrik you got from Cleveland in that cover-up deal.
Henrik was a free agent.
Yeah.
We got Henrik, Landis made him a free agent.
Yeah.
He belonged to...
Cleveland, wasn't it?
Well, it was supposed to belong to Cleveland.
Or
it was some mix-up someway.
Yeah. Cleveland had just barely, almost lost Feller the year before, you know.
They did
lose Henrik, so...
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And Charlie Keller, was he, did he come up through the system?
Yeah, he come up through the system. He went into Newark, and now I think he came out right out of college into Newark.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, that was a tremendous team, that Newark team, wasn't it? The 37 team,
particularly. Yeah, they had a good ball club, yeah.
And Oscar Witt, the manager there.
Yeah.
Buddy Rosar.
Yeah, well, Rosar come up through the... And we got Roser from Buffalo here.
He still lives here, doesn't he? Or doesn't
yes,
he
still lives here.
Did he ever become a policeman? He always wanted to be a policeman, didn't
well,
he?
Well, no. He took the examination. That was about all. He took the examination, and I don't think he made it. I don't know. That's why he left the ball club to get up here to take the examination.
Did he tell you he's going?
Yeah.
Oh, you knew he was going.
I told him if he did, I was going to suspend him, but I didn't suspend him. I got Raleigh Hemsley in the meantime. And Hemsley fit him because they only had the one catcher. He was the only catcher. Dickie was hurt and somebody else was hurt.
Well, what a powerhouse.
Huh?
What a powerhouse you had. Is it hard to manage when you got that much talent on the team?
Huh?
Is it pretty tough to manage, or pretty easy to manage when you got so much talent, you know, those Yankees?
Not easy to manage. It's easy after you win the championship and at home and everything is all right. Then it's the only happy fella in the world is the guy that wins that championship. The rest of it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's always something.
Well, you must have been real happy, all the pennants and championships you won.
Career. It was a little bitterness with a sweet, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you never finished below third, did you, or second, or maybe you finished third, but I don't know that you...
Well, I'd have to go back and look at the records. Yeah. I haven't got them in front of me here, and
seems
I couldn't
like
tell
you're
you
always
that.
Up there. Yeah. Well, you spent a little while over at Boston then, late in the...
Yeah.
How'd you like that?
Well, wonderful. I was probably... I went in there for Joe Cronin and Tommy Yawkey. Cronin wanted to go up in the office. Yawkey wanted him up in the office because Eddie Collins was sick and he had a bad heart attack. And so Cronin wanted me as the manager, and I went in. Really, I had retired at the time, and I went back for two more years and tied 1 year and got beat out the last day the next year. So I think my luck was running out, and I got tired of it.
Yeah.
So I decided I had enough.
I was in Cleveland in 1948 when you tied the Indians, you know, and had that big playoff game in Boston.
Yeah.
That was an exciting game.
Yeah.
Did you have much... doubt about who you're going to pitch that game, or
no? The other two, the only fellow that I had in, I didn't have Gale House in mind. He pitched, but I was.
I've interviewed him.
Second guess for pitching Gale House, but Gale House had beat Cleveland the last time he pitched against them in Cleveland, and the other two pitchers had pitched against New York, and I was run out. We didn't have an off day. It was.
Yeah.
End the season today and then start the playoff tomorrow. We didn't have had no time in there, but it didn't make much difference. We didn't hit the other fella anyhow.
Gene Bearden.
Yeah, he only gave us about five hits.
Yeah.
So.
That was Boudreaux's big day, wasn't it?
He
managed real well that day, hitting two home runs.
Yeah, that's right. But the funny thing, the wind changed. The wind change was blowing another direction, and the damn wind change started to blow out the left field. And they hit that fly balls out there, and it went for home runs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A real short fence there. You think Ted Williams would have, if he'd hit at Yankee Stadium, he hit a couple hundred more home runs, do you think?
Well, he would have got many, many more walks, I know that, because...
Yeah.
They pitched to him, and it's hard to tell about those things.
Yeah.
Because he hit a ball out of any park, it didn't make much difference.
Yeah. Did you like to hunt in the off season during your baseball
days? Oh, I did when I was younger, but as you grow older, as I got older, I done away with it. I stopped it.
Do you still like baseball?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You read the sporting news?
I got the sporting news.
Oh, is that right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. It's not quite like it used to be, though, is it?
No, it's 75 cents now.
Basketball in the front
page. I remember when it was a nickel.
Uh-huh.
And it was in major. It was a fellow named Richter in Philadelphia put it up.
Yeah.
And it was a big paper at the time.
Yeah.
And it was all baseball in those days. There was no professional football. And there was no hockey.
No.
And very little basketball. Basketball was played out in western Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
That is the league basketball.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you watch it on television then, I guess, the games, huh?
Oh, yes. I watched the game last night.
Yeah, that was
very good.
That's Dodgers, quite a team. They got a lot of fine young players, don't they?
Yes, they have.
Well,
and they got a great manager in Walter Alston.
Do you know Walter Alston?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I guess you've known about all the greats of the game, haven't you?
Well, I knew them. He and Ralph Hawker are about the only ones I know in the game now.
Yeah.
Of course, I know a lot of the officials, a few of them, but it's all new now.
How'd you like the umpiring when you were in baseball?
All right.
They're pretty good, you think?
Yeah.
They knew their business. Did you know Tommy Connolly?
Oh, yes, sure. They, you get a ball club fighting the umpire all the, umpires all the time, they'll finish last.
Uh-huh.
Umpires don't beat you.
Yeah.
Anytime you get a ball club, always finding fault with the umpires, look out.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell your stories first that he told when the tape wasn't on?
Well, we're riding on the thruway now. It's about the thruway. On the thruway, it's 1:15. We left McCarthy's house at 12:30. And we're now just entering the thruway west of Buffalo, heading, or east of Buffalo, heading for Syracuse. This was a kind of a hard interview. He tired quickly, and there are a lot of things he didn't want to talk about, as you could tell on the tape, and he got quite impatient with me when I asked him about some of these things without my realizing he was going to be so impatient. As soon as I got the idea, I shut the thing off and was ready to quit then, but then he wanted to wrap it up rather gracefully, so he turned it back on, finished up with a few general remarks about his years in New York and Boston. He seemed to be a little milder then. But after the tape was off, he took me on a tour of the house. We went up to his upstairs room and one of the big kind of a sitting room there with a lot of pictures of the world's champion Yankees teams. Probably everyone. He has a picture of the Chicago Cubs of 1928, too. The identical one I got from Fred Blanken half frame. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
He got that one up there. I didn't see the 29 Cub picture, but he had all the Yankee winners. And he was quite jovial and friendly, you know, after the tape was off, and he seemed to calm down a little bit. But he told a few stories which ought to be told. One is on the Lou Gehrig's last few games. He said that it was obvious Gary couldn't really do much anymore. And he himself, McCarthy, had planned to take him out of the lineup sooner or later. He didn't quite know when or how. He noticed in a game in Washington how Gary could just pick up a ball, put one arm against the grandstand and bent over, much like people like me do with bad backs, to stoop down. You got to bend at your knees and kind of support yourself. And he said, uh-oh, he's through or something. That's McCarthy's reaction. So the team went on to Detroit. They had a day off. And McCarthy stopped over his home in Buffalo, spent the day there, and then flew on the next day and caught up with the team in the morning. Went up to his hotel room and there was a message waiting for him there that Lou Gehrig wanted to see him. So he sent word for Lou to come on up. So Gehrig came up to the hotel room and McCarthy said, I asked him to repeat the phrase so I'd get it straight and I'd forgotten it already. Something to the effect of, when do you think it's the right time to take me out? Or when do you think I ought to get out of the lineup? And McCarthy said, right now. He said, okay. So that was the day he went out of the lineup. He took as team captain, he took the lineup up to the home plate before that game with the Tigers that day in Detroit. And his name was not on the lineup. Ty Tyson, the Detroit announcer, announced the lineup over the PA system. And he gave the lineup while Gehrig was still at the plate there and said, Lou Gehrig will not play in today's game. And so there's a standing ovation as Gehrig walked back to the dugout. Everybody in the place stood up and cheered. McCarthy said, I never heard anything cheering like that before in all my life. And he got back to the dugout. Gehrig just sat on a bench there and cried. The whole Yankee bench emptied. They all went back into the dressing room and are crying themselves.
Oh, that's some story. Yeah. But wasn't his farewell performance in New York?
No, they had a day for him in New York. But this is the last. The day he went out of the lineup, he never played again. We also got looking at the 32 Yankee team. They had their picture up on the wall there. Said, yeah, I went over to the Cubs and managed the Yankees. We beat the Cubs in that World Series. I said, that was some satisfaction, I'll tell you. And he chuckled at that. So he said that. And I said, now how about Babe Ruth's called home run? I said, no, nothing to it. Nothing to it. He said, he was pointing to the Chicago dugout. And I said, that's what Woody English had told me. But he was simply waving his two fingers at the dugout. He says, yeah, they were riding him to beat the band. They're the Chicago players at the third base dugout. He just pointed over there and with the two fingers, suggesting he had only two strikes on him and one left, or one strike on him and two left. And somebody up in the press box said, did you see what he did? He pointed out the bleachers where he's going to hit the ball. And that's how that story got started, but there really was nothing to it. And Baby himself later admitted that he didn't do that. That's what McCartney said. Yeah. And Ruth did later admit he hadn't pointed out the center field. The bleachers. Just happened to hit one out there. That takes care of that. As I was wrapping things up there in the sitting room downstairs where we had the interview, I asked him if he happened to know Bill Clem. Of course, he knew Bill Clem. And he was a tough one. He says, he used to ride him, you know. And the story something like I was riding him one day there, and I came out. Lost the argument, went back, I came out again and riding him. I came out sometime late in the game, riding him, and Clem says, you know, you've been out 12 times a day and you're wrong every time. What else did he say about that?
And he said, yeah, he said, but you know, I never came out and rode you when we were in Chicago.
Clem agreed.
And he said, Clem agreed. And he knew what I meant.
He meant
that he never rode him in Chicago, because if McCarthy had gone out in Chicago, then all the fans would have been on him, because they were so
anti-umpire.
Yeah, and he didn't want any trouble.
So he does it away from home.
Yeah.
Does his riding.
But he didn't do it, boss.
Okay, talk about Mrs. Richard, what her connection is and all the things she told you.
All right, Mrs. Richard was raised in the city. Now, I guess this was in Buffalo. And her mother had a store there that, right on the corner there of Corbett, where that railroad, where the stoplight was, and we took the wrong turn.
Yeah.
And her father died, so her mother said, why don't you come out here and live? This was about 20 years ago. She said, I'll give you the land and you can build the house. So they moved out there, and they built that white house that's still standing on the corner, because her mother was getting on. Well, just about 6 months after they moved in, the mother's store burned down. And the mother had a heart attack or something, or a stroke. And she decided she wanted to move back to the city and get an apartment, which is what she did, leaving Mrs. Richard and her husband out in the sticks, so to speak.
What did he do?
Well, he was a carpenter for that Friedman Furniture Company, that is a very famous furniture company that provides furniture for the White House. So they moved out there, and there she was, stuck out there, and there she had one next door neighbor whose husband was in the state hospital. She said she was bored stiff. She didn't know what to do with herself, because she didn't drive. There was no bus service. So one day she got this call. I think they must all go to the Catholic Church together, because she got a call from Mrs. McCarthy saying, would she ask this next door neighbor if she would come in and help her? So, Mrs. Marie, I'll call her because that's her name. Marie said she didn't really know the woman, but she would go over. So when she saw her, Mrs. McCarthy was calling every day. Finally, she went over, she saw this woman and asked her, and this woman said no, there was no way she would go in and help. So Mrs. McCarthy kept calling Marie, and Marie finally said, well, what is it you want, Mrs. McCarthy?
Mrs. McCarthy. How did she happen to call her?
I think they must have gone to the same church. Because I think they're all Catholic together. And she said, what is it you want? She said, I want somebody to come over and clean my floor for me. She said, oh, well, that's all you want. She said, I'll do it. She said, I'd have been glad. She said, I'll do it for nothing. She said, just to get out of the house. So she did, and Mrs. McCarthy gave her $5. And she said it wasn't necessary. Mrs. McCarthy said yes. So the next week she called her again and asked her to come over and do something. And pretty soon she just worked herself in. She didn't have to do it, but she was, because it gave her something to do. So actually, she's been with the McCarthys for 18 years. Then Mrs. McCarthy took sick. This must have been about 14 years ago. And she would come over in the morning and give her a bath and get everything all fixed up and that. And for 6 years, Mrs. McCarthy was like a vegetable. Yeah. And they had round-the-clock nursing, but she said the nurses, the money he spent, it was ridiculous because they didn't give her the care she needed. And then she died about, must have been 12 years ago, because I think she said she died about 6 years ago. She said she was 84 when she died, which would make her older than him. That's what Marie said. She was about, she was going to be 84 when she died about 6 years ago. And he didn't know what to do with himself. Now the little, as you drive in, there's the house on the right-hand side. And on the left-hand side was a little, is a little cottage.
She didn't, her house wasn't any of these places.
No, she had her, they had a brand new house that they had built when they moved out to this land that her mother gave them next to the store on that corner. There's a policeman on the other side though. So he said he didn't know what he was going to do and all this. Well, there was an old farmer and some woman living in that cottage, and it was a mess. And she went over, and whether the old farmer had a stroke and died, and the woman had moved out, and she went in and she looked at it, and she thought she could make something of that little cottage. So he said, well, if she wanted it, and she thought she could make something of it, he would give it to them rent-free. So they went in and ripped out walls and put up things and took the whole inside out. McCarthy paid for all this and just generally remodeled the whole thing. That's as cute as a button right now. And they moved in there. And she gets up in the morning, goes out and gets his paper for him, goes over and makes his breakfast about 10, straightens up the house. About 11:30, she goes back to her place, does a few chores there, comes back at noon or something, gives him his lunch or whatever she gives it to him, goes back to her own place, comes back about 2:30, goes back to her own place about 4:30. Then she and her husband both come over at 5, and she gives them their dinner, and they stay there till 9:30, and then they go back to their own place. And he's on his own till 10 o'clock the next morning.
Huh. Very interesting.
Now, McCarthy has no children. Those pictures that were up there, it, of course, they were all through the house. Did you see through the whole house?
Oil paintings?
No, no, no. All his baseball pictures. Like he had a picture of Connie Mack and one wall. And individual players scattered throughout, some cartoons of him. Well, in the back rooms there were stuff too. In the guest room.
Very few.
Which is a huge room. And he has one niece.
Describe the house. We'll get back to the
pictures. Well, it's just a typical old farmhouse with huge rooms
over
in it.
Over 100 years old, he told me.
Yeah. And all heated by radiators.
They had their own gas supply.
They had their own gas well, which costs a fortune. Because you always have to worry about the pipes coming into the house. You have to worry about the gauges. And you have to have it bagged out or something once a year, and they charge $250 to bag it out. And this has to be done there every spring, and it'll be coming up soon. And they don't even like to do it anymore. But they can't get city gas out there, so they have to keep using their own well. And that well heats the house and the cottage and the barn and where the cars are kept and the chicken coop and everything. That gas well, but it's really a pain just because you're always worried. Because you said, not this past winter hasn't been too bad, but the winter before he got up and puts on his coffee pot or his water for his coffee in the morning, and he wasn't getting any gas, and he called them over at the house, and her husband had to go out and check the gauges, and they were way down or something, and so this meant having somebody out to fix them, and she said it's a terrific responsibility having this gas well. So he has this one niece who has one son, and this one niece doesn't live that far away. She lives in New York, and she comes up and spends one night a year with him at the end of August is what she does. Takes home as much stuff as she can get out of the house gracefully or ungracefully and retires back to her own house. So the result is that they had a Mrs. McCarthy had a charm bracelet with a charm from every World Series, 7 of them, with a diamond in the center. And he asked Marie, Joe McCarthy asked Marie if she wanted it. And she said no, because she didn't go in much for jewelry and she didn't think it was right that her daughters would have it. And he said, well, I don't think I'm going to give it to my niece. She said, well, Vera is the niece. He said, what do you think I should do with it? She said, why don't you give it someplace where it would be on display and really mean something?
Cooperstown.
So he gave it to Cooperstown, and that was valued at over $5,000.
He told me a little bit about that. He didn't talk about giving it to his niece, though. He just mentioned giving it to Cooperstown.
But all his other stuff, or most of it, will go to Cooperstown. Now, they had a lot of silver in that the niece took the last time she was up, except the stuff that Marie kept back. And there's one silver tray there with the names of the Yankees on it, was when Mantle was on the team, engraved on it. And the championships the Yankees won then. And she said, I didn't give that to Marie. She said, because every year they have an auction on television for the rehabilitation for mentally retarded children. And Hubba's a sports writer, runs it. And they try to raise money. And she said, I just decided that we would donate this tray to the auction. Because she said, it's a worthwhile cause, I'm sure it would bring in a lot of money. So she's going to clean it up and donate it to them this year. And the rest of his stuff, she's trying to get him to give to Cooperstown. She said, because I just don't think his niece really cares that much for it. I said, you mean she's just out for what she can get? She said, well, I can't say that. But that's what it amounted to. And I said, what'll happen when something happens to him? She said, I suppose he'll get the house. The niece, well, she said, I don't know.
They'll
she
probably
said,
get the house, would you imagine?
I don't know, she said, you just can't tell. She said, but there are a lot of cut glass dishes and everything there. And all those, because the rooms that aren't in use were beautiful, with oriental rugs, hardwood floors. Now, the furniture, of course, is dated, but it was in beautiful condition. Some of their oil paintings are priceless, and some of their silver. And this Marie really could have anything in the house she wanted. But she doesn't like to take it. He'll say, go ahead and take it. She said, oh, I don't need it now. I said, you know what's going to happen, don't you? I said, you're not going to get it. But that's how she started working for him, and she's been working for them ever since.
She's a delightful lady,
isn't she? Isn't she, though? Very nice. But she does worry about him.
How old is she, would you say? Mid-60s?
Yeah, because her husband has been, her husband's 67. And he had a stroke last year. But in the past 4 years, she's only been away from that house 4 nights after dinner. And those were the, or 3 nights after dinner. Those were the 3 nights when her mother died. She had to go to the funeral parlor, and she was home by 10 o'clock. She's never away at night.
In our area.
Yeah, she's always there.
Well, I think we'll shut it off now. We're coming up to this first service area, and then we'll pick up after we come out, and you can talk about the house
more.
I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay, you wanted to tell the roads
back on, back on the road again now after our stop at Pembroke on the thruway. Have probably about 125-30 miles to go to Syracuse. It's about 5 minutes before 2. We got some more stories now. You're going to talk about the house first. Should we tell the stories
before? You want me to talk about the house?
Yeah, describe the house, why don't you? More.
Well, in the first place, it had the...
Speak up.
It had the eye carrier right on this.
Yeah.
And some of their silver, and this Marie really could have anything in the house she wanted, but she doesn't like to take it. He'll say, go ahead and take it. She said, oh, I don't need it now. I said, you know what's going to happen, don't you? I said, you're not going to get it. But that's how she started working for him, and she's been working for them ever since.
She's a delightful lady, isn't she?
Isn't she, though? Very nice. But she does worry about him.
How old is she, would you say?
Mid-60s? Yeah, because her husband has been, her husband's 67. And he had a stroke last year. But in the past 4 years, she's only been away from that house 4 nights after dinner. And those were the, or 3 nights after dinner. Those were the 3 nights when her mother died. She had to go to the funeral parlor, and she was home by 10 o'clock. She's never away at night. Yeah, she's always there.
Well, I think we'll shut it off now. We're coming up to this first service area, and then we'll pick up after we come out, and you can talk about the house more. I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay, you wanted to tell the roads
back on, back on the road again now after our stop at Pembroke on the thruway. I have probably about 125-30 miles to go to Syracuse. It's about 5 minutes before 2. We got some more stories now. You're going to talk about the house first. Should we tell the stories
before? You want me to talk about the house?
Yeah, describe the house, why don't you? More.
Well, in the first place, it had the...
Speak up.
It had the eye carrier right on this.
Yeah.
Had the biggest stove I ever saw. It was a big... double stove. It had 8 burners and 3 ovens in it. And then the big set of burners on one side, a big counter, and then a set of burners on the other side. And the 3 ovens underneath with the great big, whatever they call those things, you know, to move the air from the cooking over it. And built into the wall right next to it. It was like an old-fashioned refrigerator with the same kind of doors on it. Old-fashioned ice box. And on the top of that, it must have been about 6 feet wide across. And on the top was this zinc-lined place for the ice. This 6 foot wide refrigerator with all these different doors on it. So you could get into different parts of it. And on the top, where they originally put ice, was they had had it converted into a regular I don't know whether it's electric or gas. But they had a thing put in there
to keep the refrigerator going. But I had never seen anything like it, because it was just like the old wooden ice boxes, only it was power driven. And then she was saying how he's getting so picky, Joe McCarthy, as Marie was saying. She said he's always been very particular, but she said like he likes his steak so raw, or so rare, it's practically like a raw cow. And she said he eats so very, very little these days, but everything has to be cooked the way he wants it. And she said she can't eat raw steak, and then it dawned on her one time she could put her steak and her husband's in early and then put his in, because he just, I guess, has a conniption fit. She can't have any of the grandchildren over. Of course, that isn't just for him. Since her husband had the stroke, it makes him nervous when he has grandchildren over. But she just doesn't have the grandchildren over, except the one that she has, a 10-year-old who's retarded, 10-year-old granddaughter who's retarded. And this is why I think they give so much to the rehabilitation center, because she goes there. And Joe doesn't mind her coming over. She doesn't bother him. But she was talking about the niece coming down for one night, and I was saying something about maybe she could come for more. And she said, well, she doesn't want to, and he doesn't want her to, because he doesn't like people in the house anymore. People call up, and he just doesn't want them to come over. So apparently we were quite fortunate that he was even willing to see us. And in the middle of the interview, when we were drinking our coffee in the kitchen, she said, oh, there he is. He's getting tired because he's put out. That's how she could tell. He was getting tired because he got mad at something. And I didn't know what she was talking about, but obviously.
Yeah, he didn't like the detailed questions I was asking him. And I didn't realize I was tiring him, so he was going along pretty strong, and suddenly he began to.
Yeah, that's what he does.
Then you expect me to do the Yankees the same way, year by year, everybody? That's too much.
Yeah, this is the way he gets. But you see, he couldn't even stay up and watch the ball game last night because he gets tired and goes to bed. So I think that's something to.
So I got about 45 minutes interview and a few extra stories.
Then we should be very thankful for what you've got.
He said at one point, when he was a little irritated, he said, I had a lot more than anybody else ever had from him, and I didn't have very much, really. So other people don't have very much either.
No, he just doesn't.
Nobody will write a biography of him.
Well, they might do it from stuff that's left over. Every year on his birthday, they send a photographer out, and they take a picture of him and his dog. Of Joe McCarthy and their dog, of Marie's dog. Marie and her husband have a dog. But this year, the dog won't be able to get up the steps because it's getting too old. So she doesn't know what they're going to do. But when they come out for that, he doesn't really give an interview then either. Because it just upsets him.
Okay, there are a couple stories then that I wanted to get on here. Got it down in your notebook.
Yeah, the Rosar story.
Well, I asked him about Buddy Rosar. We were talking about the Great Newark team, I guess after the tape was off. And he was saying that it was a great team, but a lot of the guys that they got there didn't come up to the Yankee chain. They were acquired from other clubs and really had been developed elsewhere, but they came to Newark and then came up to the Yankees, like Joe Gordon. Henrik Rosar, he said, came up through the Yankee system, the catcher. And at once, I remember Buddy Rosar. I knew he lived in Buffalo, and I asked him if he still lived there. And he said, yes, he lives around here somewhere. And I said, did he ever really become a policeman? Because I remember all that, heard an awful lot about how Buddy Rosar wanted to become a policeman. And I remember he was actually quitting the Yankees one day and going off to Buffalo to take the civil service test. And I said, I asked McCarthy, he said, did you let him go? He said, I told him if he went, I'd fine him. He went, but I didn't fine him, though, he said. So he came back. He said, I don't think he passed the test. I don't ever hear of becoming a policeman. That's what McCarthy said, so I don't know. That was the story of Buddy Rosar. We heard a lot about his wanting to be a policeman. I remember seeing a picture in the Sporting News of him taking the civil service test there. But I thought he'd walked out of the Yankees, just left the Yankees. Apparently McCarthy said he could go, but he'd find him if he went, something like that, but he never did find him.
Now, even though he managed, he was involved in baseball so much later than most of those people we interview. He still gets upset with all these modern players with their long hair and their high big money and all this stuff, according to Marie.
Of course, I didn't even get into any of that.
No, but he can get real upset during any ball game. She has to watch that.
Well, he's done pretty well the last 88 years. Can't have gotten upset an awful lot.
Well,
Earl Hildebrand told me that he was a very heavy drinker, almost to the point of being an alcoholic. He would never show up at games that way, but he was apparently a heavy drinker, and I don't know.
Maybe he's giving it up. Maybe that's why he offered us a glass of ginger ale.
Well, I'd hope he'd give it up, or he wouldn't live this long. I asked about his wife, you know, and he didn't want to talk about where he met there. He didn't met her. He didn't know whether it was in a ballpark or a saloon. He was a frequenter of saloons. He had a, just as you were leaving, he had a Bob Shockey story, since we're going to visit Bob Shockey tonight. He offered me a glass of ginger ale, which we need then. But he said, tell Bob Shockey hello, I'll give him my best. And he said, ask him about this. Don't tell him I told you, but ask him about it. When Miller Huggins died, August of 1929, Shockey and Ruth were going down to the funeral parlor together. And Ruth asked Shockey, who he thought would be the new manager. And Shockey said, oh, I don't know who's going to be the new manager. And Ruth said, it better be me, because if it isn't, I'm going to give it an awful hard time to the guy who gets it. Of course, the irony of the story is Shockey got it.
Was his manager of the Yankees?
Yeah. Yeah, Huggins died in 1929. Shockey managed in 1930. Shockey let out. McCarthy took over in 31. 15 years. Shockey in the last 1 year. I hope he'll tell me more about his experiences and why he left, and McCarthy would about his. Any other stories down there?
Well, I can't really think of anything. As I say, the house is well kept on the inside.
Part of the house was the original part brick, or was that what was added on?
I think the original part was brick. And
it's a two-type house, brick and wood.
She said it's a very awkward situation, because she really doesn't know how his money is. You know, if anything happened to him, he had to go into a nursing home. She doesn't quite know what would happen. Whether the house would be sold or... But as I say, he paid for all the improvements on their cottage. And then her husband works around the land there. He was taking down snow fences, and she didn't want him to, because, as I say, he had a stroke last year. But he does it anyway.
He's still getting around, though, huh?
Yeah, it was a traveling stroke, so it didn't last very long, the paralysis. A traveling blood clot. And it moved away, and it got it dissolved, and he was all right.
There'll be no repercussions from that, I suppose, huh?
Yeah, she says it's given him a change in temperament. She said he was a real easygoing fellow, and as I say, he did all this carving for furniture for the White House and that. But she said, now he's as bad as Mr. McCarthy. She said, now I've got two of them to cope with. Well, they do what they want to, and then you get a lecture. Because Mr. McCarthy tells her how to cook and how to do this and how to do that. The other day, her husband was telling her how to brush her teeth. She said she was doing that almost as long. She said that's the way he's got.
She's got a nice, happy temperament.
She does.
To be able to handle that.
Yeah.
Just take it in stride, ignore it.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, it's a big, spacious house. Beautiful big piano in that living room.
Yeah.
You his wife played a little bit, he said. Going to waste that piano.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going to waste because they're never in the living room of that house.
Yeah, he says his color TVs, the little one out in the den where we were, but the beautiful big one is black and white in the living room. And he says the black and white one's good, but once you watch the color one, you don't want to watch the black and white. So he's always watching the poorer set that's got the color.
But they had a radar range in another little set in the living room, and then they've got their own television in their cottage. Because the cottage is...
They got more television sets than people to watch them.
Yeah, they have all kinds of stuff, because when the... He said every time this niece comes up, he gives her stuff. So last year when it was time for her to come up, he told her to go through this buffet, and she had never been in the buffet. And all the years she had been there, she had never gone into some of those drawers. And she said they were just loaded with silver and linens. She said so she just put all the stuff out on the dining room table, and this niece took everything that was there back with her. But she said not the baseball stuff, because most of the baseball stuff, if he wanted it and it's something, then he has it out and framed. And everything else he's gotten rid of. Now some to charity auctions and things like this. Some to Cooperstown. But I don't think he could really care less about a lot of this stuff at this point. And she just can't see anybody else getting it. So she would rather have it go to Cooperstown than some of these other things getting it. From what I gathered.
Well, I think anything else?
Not offhand.
We arrived there about quarter of 11 and rode around the cottage and didn't know where we were supposed to go. Then he came out the door and waved at us as we came back around the cottage up to the, along the driveway, which is opposite the rear door. So we went on in. Very jovial, friendly at first, but he got a little itchy in some of the questions. I had to be awfully careful. I didn't want to talk about this and that. People were dead now. Would he talk about Babe Ruth? No, he's dead now. Well, I knew he was dead now, but when there's a Ruth story, but he wouldn't. First I thought I wasn't even going to be able to get the tape recorder on. He said first he wouldn't talk to the record. That really worried me. But then I finally joshed him along and got the thing on by showing him what a beautiful machine it was. And testing his voice a couple of times, he kind of liked that, so then let it go. But left on that thing.
Oh, quite a bit, it looks like.
This side.
Oh, not too much. About a quarter of an inch?
Yeah, maybe about 15 minutes, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Well, we're on our way to Syracuse, and we'll see. Tonight, I hope to see Bob Shockey and have a little more successful interview. Signing off at 10 after 2 on Tuesday, April 15th.
Okay.
Check that window. Just thought of something else. We just spoke of this charm bracelet that was sent to Cooperstown. He told me upstairs that this was made up of the diamonds from the center of each of his World Series rings. He had the diamonds removed from the rings and made into this bracelet.
Each one was a charm for each World Series. I think there were 7 out of them, she said.
So that's where those diamonds came from. They were diamonds.
Yeah, they were diamonds because their bracelet was valued over $5,000.
He said $4,200.
Oh, well, she said $5,000. And it's on display at
That's
what
it was appraised at. Oh. And Kenny Smith said it's worth a lot more than that.
Yeah.
It's appraised value, so it's $4,200.
Well, he just had it locked up in the house. And as I say, he didn't know what to do with it, so apparently he always asked Marie what to do with things.
He says that's the most valuable thing they got in Cooperstown.
Yeah. Still has a lot of his old baseball shirts with his name on the back, you know, the old flannel ones.
Didn't know they had names in the back in those days.
Well, in the back, on the inside, he has his name, Joe McCarthy, on the flannel baseball shirts, and he insists on wearing them. And of course, they're just practically they're all holy in there, and she has an awful time with them. Because she can't really patch them anymore. And so this one that she was ironing there had a collar that's so frayed and it's already been turned and she didn't know what to do, so I was telling her to use that Texatize and that would glue it down for her if she wanted to. But he still wears his old baseball shirts.
Just around the house?
Around the house, yeah. Did you want to say something else?
No, I just wondered if you felt comfortable in them. Or...
Yeah.
He tells me he still likes the game. He had a lot of sporting news there. Or at least the sporting news. Because that's not like it used to be, of course. He watches the games on TV, so he's interested in baseball and not defined at all.
Yeah, except at night when he has to go to bed, he never sees the end of a game. He's in bed before they leave the house at 9:30.
Glad I didn't wait till any later to call him last night.
Yeah. He's in bed before they leave, and then they go to their own house. And that's probably where she watched the game. I would imagine what they said.
Okay.
Well, up in this room... Oh, I should mention that all through this house is this most beautiful wallpaper. Colonial type. No, and it's all washable. It's all like a Sanitas. That you can't, you couldn't buy that type of paper today.
Not for our bathroom?
No, but it's all over the house. This beautiful wallpaper. And in this room where he has his pictures all framed around, he has a table there with his shoe, and instead of being bronzed, it's silvered. And I think it's a mitt that's silvered there. And he has one trophy there. And then he has a couple of little miniature bats from something. But I couldn't see what they were. They're on a type of library table in that room. And then he has Manager of the Year. He has a couple of those up there.
How about the little stuffed doll? Is that what that was? Or a doll on the couch up there with the Yankees on it?
Yeah. It's a stuffed doll that says What's Yankees. That? Well, I don't know. Maybe Mrs. Richard would do that because she makes these 3 feet tall Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy stuffed dolls. She's made them for all her grandchildren and that. This is what she does to... With her spare time when she's watching television, that she makes these big dolls because she had a couple of them over there in the house. And she keeps a suitcase in her house with all her goodies in it to make these dolls. And then she just picks up the suitcase and carries it over to his house. But she also packs that suitcase up at night and takes it back to her house so it's not lying around his house.
He's got a... What do you call these seat elevators on the stairways?
Those elevator chairs.
Yeah.
Go up that.
He has an elevator chair on his stairway there, which he got for his wife. When she, what did she have, a leg?
She broke her hip.
Broke her hip. He got that for her, and they had a walker for right at the top of the stairs. You could just swing the seat around and get the walker. Around upstairs. He says, and now I'm using it.
Yeah.
As he rode up the stairs in splendid fashion. Says it takes 30 seconds. I timed it. He goes up the stairs there.
Yeah, well, you know, you saw his big bedroom with
yeah.
two beds in it. And there was a bath off that. But he doesn't like that bathroom.
They got more bathrooms than anything else in that.
So he goes around and uses the other one. And then then where the pictures are is like a little sitting room. And then as you go off the sitting room across the front of the house into a hallway, there are baseball pictures hung up in that hall. And then through the hall on the other side where the guest bedroom is, and then there's a junk bedroom back there and another bathroom back there.
Huge. Well, that bathroom's huge there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which they're all pretty big, except the one downstairs.
Yeah.
Pictures in the hall upstairs, one of the Buffalo team of 1950 that he played on. And a couple of pictures of himself with Wrigley. I took a picture of those two pictures.
One of Connie Mack.
That's downstairs. And there's one of the 100th anniversary of Doubleday's. Maybe that was the invention of baseball there. I made a sub-monument to Doubleday. All the players looked like about 1930 or 40. I didn't get the date on that. A couple of action shots. One of the violent arguments with an umpire. It didn't look like McCarthy, though. It looked like somebody else made the argument. Didn't see too many books around there, did you?
No, I didn't I didn't see any books. You know that? And I saw in a lot of the cupboards. Because at the... Just before you go into the master bedroom, there's sort of an alcove there. There are cupboards on both sides of it with all these built-in drawers for material and that. And she had a lot of her clothes made. She'd buy material when she was traveling and store it there until she had it made up.
They did a lot of remodeling inside, knocking out cupboards and building alcoves and knocking out walls and putting in doorways. He didn't do it himself. I thought I asked him. And no, he said, had somebody do that for him. His father died when he was three, you know, he never knew it.
Oh, really?
3 months. 3 months. The mother had to raise him at Benjamin.
Did you ever find out if he knew Ben Johnson?
Yeah, I asked him about that. He didn't know him. Of course, he wasn't in the American League, though, sure. I tried to find out about his mother and everything. That's one of those things he just shut off the discussion.
He only had the one trophy on the table and no other trophies in the house.